From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, those open lines, and boy, get ready for them. Here's what's happening. The space shuttle Atlantis thundering away on its final voyage to orbit, hoisting an experienced crew of six and a full shipment of space station gear. Atlantis sped through a perfectly clear afternoon sky, blazing a trail over the Atlantic before huge crowds clapping and cheering, eager to catch one of the few remaining shuttle launches. Its destination is the International Space Station, which was soaring over the South Pacific at the time of the liftoff. The shuttle should catch up with the orbiting complex and its six residents on Sunday. Undersea robots tried to thread a small tube in the jagged pipe that is pouring oil into the Gulf of Mexico on Friday, in BP's latest attempt to cut down on the spill from a blown-out well that has pumped out more than 4 million gallons of crude and took the lives of 11 people. Captain Kelly Sweeney continues to monitor this situation. Well, Kelly, what do you think about this one?
Well, George, they're going to try the tube, and then Plan B is the top hat, and we should know by the end of the weekend how that goes.
What's your gut tell you?
Well, they're going to give it their best shot. I think the tube is the best thing so far. It's like a big straw.
But it's not permanent, is it?
No, it isn't.
So what are they going to do? Kelly, what are they going to do to stop this leak?
I think the only thing they can do, George, to really stop it, as I mentioned on Monday, is that they're going to have to drill the relief well and take the pressure off of this thing. It's the only thing they can do. And, you know, to really make it a permanent fix, in my opinion. The rest of this is just to get it under control. But you know, George, on Tuesday, and this is something that, if I may,
yes,
I would like to break on Coast to Coast tonight. Nobody else is talking about this, George, and I'm sure that very few people outside the business have heard about this.
All right, have at it, Kelly.
On Tuesday, the president of Transocean stated in front of the Senate that from 3 o'clock in the afternoon until about 10 o'clock that on April 20th, the night of the explosions, that there are essentially no records of what went on that rig.
No records.
And In my opinion, that is, as a mariner, unbelievable.
Is it criminal?
Well, I think that's something to definitely be considered, George. I really do. Because this ship was equipped with what's called a voyage data recorder, a VDR, which is a black box for ships. And every vessel that I've ever worked on that had a VDR has a policy that whoever is on the bridge in an emergency is required to take that VDR down to the lifeboat in the event of evacuation and to take the written logbooks that are on the bridge, because there are a written record of what's been going on up to the minute, down there as well. In front of the Senate, the president of Transocean stated that the logbooks were missing. And the VDR, the voyage data recorder, there has not been one word about where that is.
Unbelievable story, Kelly.
It is unbelievable.
All right, my friend. Continue to monitor it. I'll be back in Los Angeles, Kelly, on Monday, and I'm sure we'll be checking in with you next week. Captain Kelly Sweeney. One of the most bizarre stories I've heard in a long time. Listen to this one. 28 wedding guests were electrocuted Friday as an overhead cable came in contact with their bus in central India. 23 women, 3 men, 2 children all died. 5 passengers jumped to safety and suffered minor injuries. The bus driver was not injured. That's what happened to them. The high voltage wire touched an iron wardrobe on the roof of the bus as it was going through. Passengers began stepping down while holding the steel railings while the current passed to the ground, causing a jolting electric shock in the bus, killing these 28 people. Unbelievable. A group of New Mexico medical school students failed to properly change needles on devices used for blood glucose testing. And now officials say a few dozen people might be at risk now for contracting serious diseases. Well, the school is trying to locate those who participated in the free testing on April 24th at the Indian Pueblo Cultural Center in Albuquerque. Between 51 and 55 people were tested that day. Talk show host Regis Philbin says he will have a blood clot in his calf removed next week. The 78-year-old co-host of Live with Regis and Kelly says leg pain is making it very difficult for him to walk. Philbin had hip surgery in December, triple heart bypass surgery a few years ago. Congress is considering legislation that would limit wineries' ability to sell and ship directly to you. The wholesale distributors who proposed the legislation say it will keep wine from minors, limit alcohol consumption, and ensure states' control of sales. So get ready for that. Now, you've seen him on Larry King. You've heard him on our show, Coast to Coast. And you've seen him on DVDs all over the place, Out of the Blue, the movie. Up next, James Fox with some incredible stories on UFOs on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back this Friday night and the Saturday morning on Coast to Coast AM. James Fox was born in England at the age of three, assisted his father as he traveled to locations for news stories. In 1993, James was introduced to the world of ufology by a close friend. Now, let me tell you, he was very skeptical until he started to investigate these on his own. In 1998, he completed his very first documentary for the Discovery Channel, which included such notables as Apollo 14 astronaut Edgar Mitchell and the late Colonel Philip J. Corso, who was in charge of the Foreign Technology Desk at the Pentagon during the Eisenhower administration. Jim will be with us for a couple hours. He's bringing a couple guests throughout the next few hours who will talk about the incredible case, of course, of UFOs. Here he is, James Fox. Hey, James, how are you?
I'm doing well. I thank you so much for the introduction. My gosh, I didn't realize that I've actually done a few things.
Not bad. You either have a good PR person or we wrote this up pretty darn good.
Well, I wanted to mention, I'm actually in Phoenix. I just flew into Phoenix. I'm actually at the Open Minds magazine to attend a gathering at the Vision Quest bookstore tomorrow. And there's details of it, of the event on the Phoenix UFO Examiner. So I wanted to kind of put that out there. So if there's anybody in the area, Phoenix area, that wants to attend, come on over.
I've got to ask you, how do you get on Larry King's show so often?
That's a good question. For some crazy reason, I think they like me. they have mentioned a couple of times that they find they're fascinated by the subject of UFOs, and they find me somewhat credible because I'm reluctant to discuss things that I can't back up, and I bring military witnesses on board with me to cooperate any stories that I put forward in my films, and I think they like that, and I think that it gives them good ratings, and so CNN's happy, and they're fascinated with the subject. Now, Larry King is fascinated with the subject. He's questioned a lot of the witnesses I brought on behind the scenes during commercial breaks, and I've had some, you know, some screenings with a few of the CNN executives, private screenings of I Know What I Saw.
Mm-hmm.
And it rates well. UFOs rate well.
Yeah, they do. Now, how many documentaries, Jim, do you have under your belt?
UFO documentaries, I'm going to say 3.5, because I did a second version of Out of the Blue, which was completed, but then it ended up rolling into I Know What I Saw. And it's funny, some people here at Open Minds were questioning me about an hour ago, well, are you going to do another UFO documentary? And I said, well, the last time I said I'd never do one, I did another one, and I said it again, and I did another one, so who knows?
And the subject matter generally is what? Subject matter.
My feeling is this. I think that the subject matter of UFOs is so sensational on its own. The only thing lacking is credibility. So my philosophy is, if you can bring credibility to the subject matter, you've got yourself a winner. And I've had some criticism in the past from people in the UFO field saying, oh, well, James isn't really introducing anything new here. It's, you know, it's the same some of the cases. But my response to that is, hey, let's create a body of evidence that can be presented or can transcend the UFO community and be presented to mainstream in a digestible sort of fashion. And so I think with I Know What I Saw and Out of the Blue, we were, you know, the proof is, you know, I mean, we've been on Larry King a number of times, and they've sort of stand behind that. So that's been my goal the whole time.
You have worked a lot with the former Arizona Governor Fife Symington, who, as you know and everybody else, James, when that Phoenix Lights situation occurred in 1997, he made fun of it. He had an alien at the news conference, a guy dressed up in a costume, and then he recanted. Then later, years later, he said, you know what? I made a mistake. He went on Larry King's show with you. I was on that program, and he admitted there's something else going on. Yeah.
He went on a couple times with us, and there's a really interesting point I'd like to make right now, actually, since you brought the governor up. And one is, there are a lot of people behind the scenes that are very influential, very in a position of power and access. Governor Symington is one of those people. He is so courageous to come forward publicly like he's done, because there are so many people behind the scenes that have helped me. But when it comes down to them putting their name on it officially or publicly, they bow out almost every time. And I can't tell you, like, I'm going to say this tonight on the radio. Steven Spielberg watched my movie, and he wrote an amazing letter about it. And I have the letter encased in like a vacuum sealed frame at my house, but I can't go public with it. You know, and I'm talking to his press guy, and I'm saying, well, why not? You know, all of the themes behind his movies are UFO related. And, you know, Dr. Jalen Hynek, the very foundation of his work in Project Blue Book Files, is the basis of Close Encounters of the Third Kind. He even has a cameo appearance. And yet, he enjoyed my movie, but he won't endorse it in any way. I mean, you know, the difference that would make would be monumental. But
why won't he? What's he holding back for?
It's a really good question.
If you make a commitment like that, you're in it, right?
Yeah, I guess so. I think that he knows as well as anyone else. I mean, if and I'm not just tooting my own horn, but I know what I saw is very difficult for anyone to walk, no matter how skeptical you are, to walk away from it thinking that there's nothing to it. And I think he realized that. I don't know. I'm just speculating here, but he's just not prepared. He said, not at this point. And he just won't do it. But I have a letter from him. I mean, of course, my father said to me, he said, well, you could publish the letter because technically it's probably, I wouldn't do that. You know what I mean? But I have a letter with all the, I'm not making this stuff up. You know,
it's signed, right?
Exactly. And I know how he feels about the subject. He feels, you know, some, you know, parallels my sentiments. Let's put it that way.
James, of everything you've done in your field here of ufology, is there a case that you've researched that still baffles you, that still frustrates you?
Well, you know, one of the things that we're working on now is assembling, we have the 30-year anniversary of the Bentwaters case. That case to me is so significant, and it's recent enough where the witnesses aren't really old. And, you know, we have the 30-year anniversary coming up, but the fact that the thing was sitting on the ground, it was touched and photographed, and there were symbols on the side of the craft, which we had analyzed, that to me is so significant. I remember editing with my editor Boris Zuboff in San Francisco, and his wife would always be kind of like lingering in the background for years. We did Out of the Blue together. We did some stuff on I Knew What I Saw, and she never paid any attention to UFOs. She wasn't interested. But when she heard Jim Peniston and John Burroughs and Kabansag talk about touching this spacecraft, she literally stopped everything she's doing and she said, "He flipping touched it." You know, that's really significant, you know, and the fact they got the radiation readings, they got imprints in the ground, they got the casts, plaster casts taken, then you've got the subsequent later nights with the colonel. And by the way, I almost had a statement from General Gordon Williams that I was going to present and even get him on the radio with us tonight, but he had some health complications and is in the hospital. So,
well, we've got a couple of people joining us over the next couple hours that you brought forward. James Peniston coming up right after the break, who will tell us some incredible things. Bentwaters, by the way, the Rendlesham case we're talking about was in England.
And yeah, December 1980.
Yeah, Linda Moltenhaus done some research on this too, James, as you know. It is an incredible case. What keeps driving you, though? Why do you keep into this? Why don't you just stop?
I know. Well, a couple of reasons. One is, and I think that the audience out there listening tonight can agree with me on this, if you can just imagine for a moment, hypothetically, whether you believe in UFOs or not, if they were real, I think everyone could agree that it would be one of the most significant discoveries of our time. I think it would have a very unifying effect on all of us, a very humbling effect on all of us.
I would put it up there with Noah's Ark, the Ark of the Covenant, and UFOs. And even though both of those biblical events to me are just historical, the thought of UFOs and ET visitations would be, I think, one of the biggest stories of all time.
Absolutely. And so having said that, having gone around the world and meeting with all these military guys and civilian witnesses, I'm convinced that these things are real. I don't know who's piloting them. Either way, either we're in possession of technology that's so far beyond anything we have, we wouldn't have to be tapping in oil. I was listening to the report earlier about that oil spill. I mean, it's catastrophic. So either we're in possession of this technology that could replace all these fossil fuels, or we're being visited. And in either case, that's an extraordinary story. And I can't walk away from it, George.
Well, and what amazes me too, James, you know, I came back this weekend from the X conference in Washington, D.C. There are so many diehard researchers who are devoting their careers to trying to get the answer here. I mean, I've never seen people so, I don't want to use the word obsessed, but I have never seen so many people so concerned about getting the answer to this.
Well, I'm really glad you brought that up with the other people researching. One of the things that really frustrates me, and I really think it's time for get some serious traction on this whole issue, is the fact that there's all this bickering going on among UFO researchers, and competitiveness and bickering, and I would like nothing more if we can all combine forces and focus on a common goal. You know, let's stop the bickering. Let's work together, because I have to quote Pink Floyd on this. You know, together we stand, divided we fall. I think there's enough resources out there, there are enough people out there that we can actually make policy, a shift in policy with this. But it's going to take us all kind of putting our differences aside and focusing on a common goal and working together. And I really hope anyone out there is listening to this. I've started a website. It's, I have a fan page now on Facebook.
Oh, are you there now, huh? You welcome to the 29th century. Right?
Exactly. Well, I put this Facebook page, and I thought, no one's going to even notice this thing. I don't even know why I'm doing this. You know, and everyone kept saying, yeah, you got to do this. And so I put the photo galleries together, and I put some links on the video, you know. And 3 days later, I look over, and I got 1,500 people signed up. And I thought, wow, this is a really good way to network. We can really work together on this. I can communicate with people. I don't need a radio station or TV station. You know, we can do the Twitters and we can do the Facebook. And so it's an amazing tool in that respect. And I'm asking anyone to go on to Facebook and sign on, and I will keep you, everyone in the loop, and really keep pushing forward on this.
We set up a Twitter feed for coasttocoastam.com some time ago, and it is amazing to get information out to people.
It's phenomenal.
You cannot beat the technology for speed.
And then you're suddenly connected with all the people they're connected, and then keeps going. It's truly phenomenal, and it's hard for me to kind of grasp the whole shift in technique and getting this stuff out there. But it's extremely effective, and I think that it's going to be a boon for this whole movement. And by the way, I just wanted to, if you wouldn't mention that, you'd mentioned out of the blue. It's actually I Know What I Saw, and I have a little link on my website. For anyone who, any cases out there, any photographs out there, or anyone who wants to be a part of this movement to sign up, put their name on our website, I'll communicate directly with them, or go to the Facebook page.
You're still chasing these answers, James, aren't you? You're looking for them.
George, I can't walk away from it. As much as I'd like to, I just can't. I have other interests. I'm doing conservation films. I'm doing stuff on Antarctica. But my passion is I can't walk away from it. I also feel like I have people that have supported me and continue to support me, and that I don't want to let them down. I'd like to see congressional hearings in my lifetime. I'd like to see it soon. I'd like to organize screenings in Washington, D.C., and have members of Congress and the media there. I'd let them interact with witnesses, let them learn about the subject matter, and do away with this whole tongue-in-cheek thing that's happening with the media. I think it's time for some serious reporting on this.
I think so, too. Now, we're going to bring James Peniston in just a few moments. And he will be able to talk with us about his situation and his case. How did you find him, James?
You know, it's so funny. It took me so long to get James Peniston to even listen to me. I had to get through to so many different people. I finally got to him, got with him, and we've been great friends. We keep in touch with each other all the time. And I think I spent 5, 6, 7, 8 years trying to reach him, and I couldn't even get to him.
Well, we got him now, and he's next with you on Coast to Coast AM. With our special guest for a few hours tonight, James Fox. We're bringing in James Peniston in just a moment. He was at Bentwaters, England. It's an incredible story, and we'll have James's event and his testimony, basically, on Coast to Coast AM. Hey, on our Saturday Coast to Coast show, join Ian Punnett with his guest, Sidney Kirkpatrick. Now, I interviewed Sidney some time ago when he wrote an incredible story about Edgar Cayce, the American prophet. Now he's talking about Hitler's holy relics. It's a great, great program. And then on Sunday, George Knapp joins us as he talks with Judge Jim Gray about the war on drugs on Coast to Coast AM. And you're listening to Coast Worldwide. I'm George Norrie. The Rendlesham Forest Incident is the name given to a series of reported sightings of unexplained lights and the landing of a craft of unknown origin in Rendlesham Forest in England in late December of 1980. Some ufologists believe it is perhaps the most famous UFO event to have happened in Britain, ranking amongst the best-known UFO events worldwide. It has been compared to the Roswell UFO incident in the United States. It's sometimes referred to as Britain's Roswell. Now, the Ministry of Defense there has denied that the event posed any threat to national security, whatever that means, and stated that it was therefore never investigated as a security matter. I like how they hedge that. Well, we've got for you for the rest of this hour, along with James Fox, James Peniston. He entered the Air Force in 1973 and was assigned to the Strategic Air Command Elite Guard in Omaha, Nebraska. In 1980, he was placed in charge of the security police plans and programs at RAF Bentwaters in England. Here's James Peniston. James, how are you, sir?
I'm doing just good there, George. How are you?
Great. Thank you for serving, by the way.
Well.
Now, tell me a little bit about your mission. Yeah, so you were out that way. Tell me about the command that you took following the incident. What actions?
Well, once I was notified and was dispatched to go off base for a possible aircraft downing, I assembled the team and went approximately about 300 yards off base where we had our encounter with a craft of unknown origin.
What did you see, James?
Well, as we approached the tree line, it was a very bright light emanating from the woods. But as we got a little bit closer, the light started to dissipate, and we could see a silhouette of a craft, the shape of the craft forming. And as we get up with it, maybe within 10, 15 feet of it, the bright light had dissipated altogether, and there was just lighting of blue and red running through the fabric of the craft.
Could you see shape at this point?
Oh, it was defined shape. It was triangular in shape. It measured approximately 6.5 feet high by 9 feet on the ground. It was in most of the area of the craft itself was probably about 60% or 70% opaque, black-like fabric. Of the craft was black light, more like a glass finish.
I'm not going to ask you about origin yet, James, but you have no doubt that this was a physical structure, right?
Oh, there's no doubt about that. The craft was situated on the forest floor, and it was solid and it was unmovable.
It left imprints in the ground, which they have the plaster casts of.
That's right, James. You know, the ground temperature at that time, because the next morning was measured or was taken, and it was like 31 degrees. And the depressions were anywhere from 1.5 to 2 inches in the ground. So it was quite heavy, but light for aircraft standards. It was probably, later on a team had estimated what the weight was based on the ground temperature, and they estimated about 7 tons. And, you know, that's very light for an aircraft, even a fighter aircraft, you know, 25, 30 tons.
How long did you stay out there, James, witnessing the craft?
I was doing a 360 around the craft, doing my investigation, trying to determine if the craft is hostile.
How close did you get?
I was right at the craft. I mean, I was.
Oh my God!
I was right next to it, and I was actually physically touching it. You know?
Yeah, touching it. Yeah.
You know, yes, Jim, go ahead.
I'm so sorry to interrupt, but I just want to emphasize that Jim Pennison wasn't alone. He was actually with John Burroughs and Ed Kabansag. Ed Kabansag wasn't at the actual craft, but he walked out towards the craft with them and then stayed back as he was a relay for the radio transmission.
He was the radio relay. Yeah, the actual two people around the craft was myself and Airman Burroughs.
Yeah.
But, we also had our whole security contingent, less than 300 yards away, which is another 16 security policemen there.
Yeah, Burroughs was in D.C. with us this weekend Linda Moulton Howe. They gave great testimony, as you do, James. So when you touched the craft, what did it feel like? Was it hot? Was it cold?
The craft was somewhat warm. But you got to remember the temperature outside was 32, 33 degrees, and it felt warm to the touch. The air around the craft was giving an electrical charge off. If we could feel that on our clothes, our skin, our hair. Of course, some of that might have been a little adrenaline going on there, but it was consistent. And even after I settled down. I determined there was no threat that I could see from this craft. It was sitting there inert. I conducted, a further investigation of it by walking around it, taking my notes. We had taken pictures going up to it. And then it was on the ground approximately 45 minutes. And then it started to generating light throughout the fabric of the craft, and it started to get brighter. And John and I, Airman Burroughs, we took a defensive position, probably about 25 feet from the craft, and watched it rise up to tree level, hover momentarily, and then take off in a blink of an eye.
Without any sound, air disturbance?
There was no sound. There was no air displacement. Let me describe something a little bit better with the craft describing it.
All right, James.
Some of the things I was looking for on the craft, obviously, were crew compartments, intakes, exhausts, things of that nature. And it was void of all those. It was a solid surface on it. And for the 9 feet long by 6.5 feet high, it was a very small craft. And I was looking for the crew compartments. I said, this has to be a one-seater or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But there was just no windows at all. And that's the other odd thing on takeoff, besides not having the air displacement that you get from engines and noise, I could not determine what the power source was for that.
So you couldn't see any engines or a hole in the middle of it or anything like that?
Oh, absolutely not. It was completely foreign. I have never seen anything like that.
Any insignias on it at all, James, or any markings that...
Right, one of the things I recorded on the far side of the craft, I was looking at it, there were symbols, pictorial-type symbols, that were etched into the fabric of the craft. And they measured a few inches high, and they stretched out for about, I would say probably 2 feet. And these were completely foreign, too. I've never seen anything like them. One of the interesting things about those symbols in the film that James did, I Know What I Saw, is he had taken those to a professor in England, and they had examined them and come up with possibilities of what they were. And their answer was it was some type of mathematical cipher of some kind.
It was mathematics. I remember the mathematician saying to me when I gave him these symbols that a light bulb went on in his head. It was almost like he kind of thought he might have decoded it. And one of the things they've always said in the past, Jim, is that the only universal language, of course, I'm not a mathematician myself, but I've been told the only universal language is mathematics. So that's the one way that we could communicate with an extraterrestrial race. And when he looked at these symbols, some of them obviously didn't make any sense, but some of them did. And he thinks, what's that sequence? But it's found everywhere in nature. And
Pi?
Fibonacci. Fibonacci. The Fibonacci sequence. He saw that in one of the symbols.
Let me ask you this, James. If there was one occupant in there, let's say, well, let me rephrase it. If there was an occupant in there the size of a human being, how many do you think could fit in there? Just the one?
One small human being, yes.
All right. If,
here's the other thing that could not happen. It couldn't have been manned, not with a human being. Now, I know this because when the craft accelerated from 0 miles per hour, and whatever the speed would be in a blink of an eye, be out of sight, which I would imagine be thousands of miles per hour, nobody would be able to withstand the G-force involved with an acceleration like that.
Well, let me ask you, was it an acceleration, or did it disappear as if it went into another dimension or through a portal?
Well, from my point of observation, it was just blink and it was gone.
Gone.
But I'm going to other eyewitnesses that are around Bentwaters and in the weapon storage areas and stuff like that, they actually seen it go ahead and head north, as a streak.
Okay.
So I'm just going by what the other witnesses have said to me on that.
Okay. What if there were ET occupants in this craft, but they weren't the size of human beings? They were 6 or 7 inches tall, let's say. Let's just say that. How many could be in there then? Many?
Well, if they were 3 or 4 feet tall, George, they'd probably be able to handle 3, maybe 4.
Look how many people they got in the Gemini mission. Those capsules were tiny.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They got them at the Smithsonian. Look in there. It's like a tin can.
They squeezed the two in there, didn't they, side by side?
Yeah.
Well,
yeah, it would have been very tight quarters, I'm sure. But I'm thinking, a 6 foot person, it would have been very, very, very tight for one person there.
Did we have drones in 1980, James Fox?
Gosh, James Pattison would be more.
No, we didn't have any drones.
No drones then. Okay.
No.
Did you think at any point, James, that this was man-made? The United States has it, or Britain has it? But it's man-made. Did you think that at all while you were looking at it?
That was the last thing that came to mind. The last thing. It was not man-made. It wasn't the James Book of known aircraft. And I'll tell you what, as a security policeman over there, we were routinely, 2 or 3 times a month in our security police training, showing silhouettes of all NATO aircraft, all U.S. aircraft, all Warsaw Pact aircraft. It wasn't a standard aircraft.
Can I mention something really quickly? Because this is the propulsion is what gets me, James. There was an article in Life magazine, I believe it was published in 1952, and it was an investigation from Life, and I know the Air Force cooperated with Life magazine on this. And one of the conclusions, which I feature, and I know what I saw, but they say known propulsion could account for the performances of these devices. And that was the conclusion in 1952. And it applies exactly to what Jim Pattison's talking about. There is just no known propulsion behind this craft. I mean,
they're using anti-gravity, and they've got to be using it with some form of magnetics.
Yeah, with no sound and no wake, no air disturbance, no sonic boom. How can you accelerate something from a standstill to out of sight? I talked to people witnesses that saw this massive craft a mile across flying over Phoenix in 1997, March 1997, and a whole family saw it just take off and in the blink of an eye. Exactly how James Pattison describes this craft taking off is this craft that was a mile across. They said literally had I blinked, I would have missed it. It shot off. With no sound, no air disturbance.
There could have been a mothership, too. And this may have been, you know, going back up to it.
What is this?
George, that technology, it cannot be replicated today. I mean, it's just the maneuvering and the with no sight. There was complete silence. It was silent running craft. I mean, we have nothing that's silent running. And I doubt if we'll have anything in the next 50 years that's silent running.
What happened afterwards, James? I'm very, very interested in finding out what the reaction was of your superiors after the fact.
Well, immediately that morning, of course, we were debriefed by the shift commander. He was the number three guy at the squadron. And both John and I were debriefed. And he took the debriefing quite well and reminded us why he was tapping his pencil on the table that Project Blue Book ended in 1969, and we had no way of actually reporting this. Then myself and John were put on 6 days off, and during that time, at least I did, and I think John did some work on it too, we took time to do our notes, and statements were made, and the reports were furnished to the command headquarters, and also major debriefings were accomplished. We had the one by the day shift commander, and then we also had detailed ones that followed because those were top secret briefings, and I did have a top secret clearance, so I was privy to mainly doing them, and John wasn't. He had a U.S. secret. Then I also had a one-on-one with the deputy base commander, base commander, wing commander, debriefing. Then we had the situation the following night with Halt, Colonel Halt. Hey,
that's right.
And after the second incident, when he went out to debunk it, debunk the first one, Halt got tied up into a situation he didn't know what was, he couldn't explain either. And then all of a sudden, after that faltered, we started having more and more debriefings on it.
James, I've got to tell you, your description of what you saw is probably one of the best I have ever heard. James Fox, would you agree?
Absolutely, beyond a shadow of doubt. And the more people we come on board, and this is like one of the strongest cases that we have today. There's tangible evidence. There's radar report readings, high radar levels at the exact location of where this thing landed. There's the plaster cast of the imprints in the ground. There's multiple eyewitness testimony. There are the symbols on the craft. James, how many people saw this thing take off on the base?
Well, there was over 80 security policemen that were on duty, and they seen it up to 3 miles away. Our sister base was RAF Bentwaters, and it was 3 miles away, and that was observed on takeoff from that base.
Just a minute. Were there any windows in it, James, or little portals or anything?
No, it was completely a solid surface. I looked all over. I looked underneath it. I looked on the sides. I mean, I was looking for some way to I knew there was going to be questions. I mean, I had to go ahead and do the best I could as far as ascertaining what was,
You said there were pictures. Who's got them?
They were turned into the base photo lab, and when we went down to pick them up, they were all whited out. So,
oh my God!
I don't know if they're whited out from the radiation, or if it was intentional, or what.
Well, you know, Colonel Pennis. Sorry. Jim.
Thank you very much, James. I appreciate it.
Colonel,
yeah, he's been a friend. James, we're coming up. We're coming up to the clock.
I'll be really quick. Colonel Halt said that an unknown agency, he was deputy base commander, an unknown agency came in a day or a couple days later and sort of sanitized everything, took some of the witnesses, interrogated them, subjected them to sodium pentothal. That's what Colonel Halt said, and he had no control of it, and he doesn't know where the agency came from.
Truly amazing. Up next, another witness who listened to the radio transmissions the night of the encounter. James Peniston, thank you so much. Incredible detail. I'll be back in a moment.